Well, I don't know. I might like do a thing where you drop one. Or I'll just end up with too many.
I thought I'd finish off that problem I started last time, because it's a fantastic one. It's kind of a good way to end the material that we're doing. I hope you noticed on Blackboard, I put your final exam part one, take-home part, score, and I also uploaded a PDF of your graded paper there that you should be able to see. I hope you can all see those. I promised you I'd let you know. So you notice I put some columns on Blackboard of homeworks, total homework score. We had 8 homeworks. So it's 8 times 20 scaled, so that it's a total of 100 points. So divided by 1.6. So that's your total homework score. That makes it equivalent to one of the exams. And so you have the midterm, in-class midterm 100. The take-home thing was 100 more. And your homework score adds up to 300 total points. And I promise that I'd tell you that if you got a certain score at this point, you're guaranteed a certain grade, and you can decide if you want to take the in-class final to maybe improve your grade. Taking the in-class final can only improve your grade. If you bomb it, it won't reduce this promised grade. So here's how the scores came out. So if your total score, I decided some people deserved an A+ even at this point. I was going to think about making you come and take the in-class thing, but some people have near-perfect everything. So if you got a score in that range, I'd call that an A+, guaranteed. 276 through 285 seems like a solid A, guaranteed. 270 through 275 at this point is an A-, so that would be a good incentive to come and improve that if you're in that A- group there. 250 to 269 felt like a B+, so those could be improved if you wanted to come and give it a shot. 219 to 249 B, 200 to 218, a B-, and then 150 to 199, the C range. So that's So those are guaranteed scores. If you don't take the final, that's the grade you would get based on your total score. And I'll repeat, if you take the final and bomb it, it won't reduce your grade. But if you do better than your current average, it will contribute to your final grade. So it can only improve it. It might leave it the same. Questions about that kind of stuff? The in-class written final will give us 100 points. And it'll be more straightforward and computational than the stuff like homework and the take-home final. So let's see, I was wanting to show this classic fact. It was problem six, number 16 on page 92, we have that F is lip 1. It's 2 pi periodic, and it's in Lipschitz 1 space, which means that F satisfies F of x minus F of y is less than or equal to some constant times x minus y. So graphs that have kinks are like that, like my tent string pluck shape. So then the conclusion is going to be that the Fourier coefficients for F are absolutely summable. So we're going to show that the sum as n goes from minus infinity to plus infinity of the Fourier coefficients, the modulus, is finite. And so that means the Fourier series converges absolutely and uniformly. So the Fourier series converges to F absolutely and uniformly by the Weierstrass M test. Okay, and so part A we did last time. It was the first hint. If we define a shifted function g sub h of x equals f of x plus h minus f of x minus h, you can think of those two functions as being kind of close together. I shifted a little bit to the right, and I shifted a little bit to the left, and so those would be close together when h is small. And I did Parsevals. Let's see. So one thing to note was that the Fourier coefficient is equal to e to the minus I n h times the Fourier coefficient n, and this one is minus e to the I n h Fourier coefficient sub n. And that allowed me to, when I use Parsevals, would give me that the 1 over 2 pi times the integral of g sub h, integral from minus pi to pi, I guess we're going from 0 to 2 pi here, why not? It doesn't really matter. Of gh squared, by Parsevals identity, that is equal to, when I take that e to the minus I, this one minus that one, I'm going to divide by 2i and multiply by 2i. So that's going to give me a sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity. Let's see, so when I do it like this, it's going to be these coefficients. I'll have a 2i, and I'll have an e to the I n h minus e to the minus I n h over 2i. There'll be a minus in there probably to clean it up. Squared times the Fourier coefficient squared. So that's the sum of these Fourier coefficients. And that would be 4 times the sine function squared. So this would be 4 times the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of the absolute value of sine times nh squared f hat n squared. Okay, so that's just a straightforward application of Parsevals. But think about how small that sum is going to be. Let's see. So, but, let's think, gh of x, that's f of x plus h minus f of x minus h. And by the Lipschitz estimate, that's going to be less than or equal to m times x plus h minus x plus h minus x minus h, which is, what is that? That's 2h. 2h times m. So that sum is going to be kind of small when h is small. That's a cool thing to note. Okay, so what do we have here so far? When I put it all together, I get this inequality. The sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of absolute sine nh squared times f hat n squared is less than or equal to k squared h squared when you put it all together. Okay, let's put that in a big red box. And you think there might be a pi in there somewhere, but it cancels out. So I guess people who studied Fourier series must have spent a lot of time staring at that thing. See, sine has humps. And so if I have big humps someplace, I can see that a major chunk of this series is nice and bounded at the top of a big hump. And so the idea is, well, I'm going to take h to be small, and I'm going to look at this on the tops of humps and get an improved estimate, which is incredibly clever and sneaky. And so the next hint, whoever thought about this for weeks and weeks, came up with this next hint, which is I'm going to partition all the integers into groups where the tops of humps are. So let's let p be a positive integer. And let's let h be equal to pi over 2 to the p plus 1. And Stein's hint is to show that the sum, we're going to take a sum from 2 to the p minus 1 less than absolute n, less than or equal to 2 to the p of f hat squared is less than or equal to k squared pi squared over something gigantic, 2 to the 2p plus 1. You think, oh my gosh, that's going to be hard, but it's actually a snap. Because the sine function, that's going to be the top of the hump of the sine function. And so it's just going to be a matter of pulling that sine stuff out to the other side. So the thing in the red box is what I'm thinking about using here. Instead of sines, it means the sine functions here are all bigger than something. And I got to figure out what they're bigger than. So let's think about it. So I'm going to think, let's see, so I'm going to have my range here is, this is a sum as k goes from, we'll have 2 to the p minus 1 plus k. As k goes from 1 to, let's see, when it gets to 2 to the p minus 1, that would get me up to 2 to the p. That's the range of that sum. Right, so when k is 2 to the p plus p minus 1, I get 2 times 2 to the p minus 1, and that's 2 to the p. So that's how I would get up to the far end of that thing. And so look at this. I've got my sine function. I'd have sine n times h. So my n is going to be this thing. It's going to be 2 to the p minus 1 plus k times h, and h is pi time over 2 to the p minus 1. And if you think about what that is, that range in this range of things, let's see, the first one would be pi over 4. plus k times pi over 2 to the p minus 1.
And so this is the sine function, and it's going from pi over 4 out to this thing. Let's see, when k is 2 to the p minus 1, that would be another pi over 4.
So if you think about the sine function, that's going to be the top of a hump. So here's the sine function. At pi over 4, that's 1 over the square root of 2. And this next thing at the far end, when k is at the end, 2p minus 1, that would be pi over 4. So let's see, this is equal to pi over 4 plus pi over 4 when k is at the right end point, when k is 2 to the p minus 1. In other words, pi over 2. So that'd be the top of the hump here. And so there'll be a bunch of little dots going along there, 2 to the p minus 1 of them.
And that's where sine is a big thing. And so the aha is that that squared,
the sine squared terms, are all going to be greater than or equal to 1 over the square root of 2 pi squared. A square root of 1 over the square root of 2 squared. So it's greater than a half. So what I see here is that 1 half times my sum of the f hat n squareds over my range here. I don't think I'll write my range again. The range I care about. That's less than or equal to a sum of the sine squared, the sine nh squared terms, times f hat n squared. And that's so the sum over the range. And now I'm going to do a really gross estimate here. The gross estimate is that's less than or equal, that's less than, in fact, well, let's say less than or equal to, the sum over the whole shebang. And remember, we had an estimate, that's less than or equal to k squared h squared. And h is pi over 2 to the p minus 1. That's the h.
And so the sum of my fn's over that range is something really small.
So I just put a 2 over there. Let's see, when I put the 2 over here, the sum over my range of fn squared is less than or equal to, when I put the 2 on the other side, there'd be a k squared, pi squared, 2, see what I squared, I get 2p minus 2, and when I multiply by 2, I'd get 2p minus 1, plus 1. Oops, but that's 2. My h was this over 2 to the 2 plus 1. That's my h. Yeah, so it'd be 2 plus 2p plus 2, but this 1 half cancels it out. So I get 2p plus 1. That's cool. Okay, in fact, that's where that's most of the thinking goes in. And now the rest of it is going to be playing games with the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. So next is my, I use the Koshi Swartz, like I did last time. Let's see. What's Koshi? So this is what I really care about. Summation range of f hat n.
I want to think of that like a dot product. So that's the vector 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 dotted with this vector. So that when this vector comes out, it's going to give me a square thing.
So this is going to be the vector. One, 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 dotted with my vector of f hats, f hat k. As k goes from over the range. And so by the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, that's going to be less than or equal to the sum of those 1 squared, square root, times the sum of my f hats, I guess I should call these n's, over my range, n is going to range over the range, squared to the 1/2.
And I'm going to square that in that thing so I have this nice, I don't want this square root in there. All I want to show is that this is finite.
Let's see, do I read? Let's see, what is this thing? I got to figure out what this is. And I'm not going to square it. Let's see. Remember that k went from 1 to something. So that the number of things in that thing was 2 to the p minus 1. So this is going to be 2 to the p minus 1 to the 1/2. That's the number of numbers in my range. And that one I just estimated and got it estimated by k squared, how convenient, they're all squared, pi squared over 2 to the p plus 1 to the 1/2.
And now when I partition all the numbers in those ranges, I would get a sum of terms like this, and these are a geometric series, are they?
This was a 2p plus 1. Why isn't my eraser working? Uh-oh. Eraser, stroke. There we go. Sorry. This was 2p plus 1.
So the mind-blowing thing is, when I clean this up and look at it, what's going to be left over here is a geometric series.
So I add up over the ranges, so finally, add up all the sums over the ranges over P and compare to a geometric series. And that's the end of it.
So that's kind of a deep result, and the proof is incredibly clever. But you know all the tools you need to do it. It's just a matter of sitting around and thinking about something clever to do like that. Apparently that's a standard trick in Fourier analysis, to take dyadic partitions in clever ways. So if you were to get deeper in this stuff, that's a standard trick.
What's a dyadic partition?
In terms of cutting it, powers of two.
By the way, the next hint, of course, the sign's last one is always the hardest one. Oh, yeah, guys, going to tutor.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor.
I'm not going to do this last part, but part D is that this argument can be refined a little bit, and you get the same result. It's called Bernstein's theorem for lip alpha functions, but not all alpha between 0 and 1, but alpha bigger than 1/2. So let's see, we got the case 1, so we would have 1/2 less than alpha, less than or equal to 1. That's called Bernstein's theorem. If you're into this stuff, that'd be a fun thing to think about. The last little piece of material I was going to do before I do some review on Friday, I thought another thing to do, fun thing to do on Friday would be to talk about how to apply to graduate school in math, since I figure there's some people in here who are thinking about stuff like that.
That would be great. Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to talk about one of the problems on the take-home thing, which is basically the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. That's problem 2 on the take-home thing, on the final exam, part 1, which is that you can't have the F and its Fourier transform both having compact support. F and F Fourier transform cannot both have compact support. Oh, you know, I slipped up when I defined the support the other day. The support of F is equal to the closure, I skipped the word closure, of the set where it's not vanishing.
Yeah, that was like confusing.
Because it's not closed. The set where it's not zero is open.
Right.
And when you close it, you get something closed. And being compact means that's closed and bounded. So it just means the support is squished inside an interval when you're talking about real value functions. When you're talking about things in several variables, it's more interesting. And I fixed that in the notes when I posted them. So this is what you had in the thing, and Stein's hints, of course, were very useful. So step 1, funny, not many people explained why I could shift the support and jam it into the interval from 0 to 1/2. So step 1 is, let's suppose we have that F and F hat have compact support. I'm going to get a contradiction. Okay, so it's a fact that if I, so little facts you need. I can translate functions, and I can scale functions, and that fact would persist. So let's see, if I take f of x plus a shift, remember that's e to the minus I h, times f hat. Or something like that.
So it would still be true if I shift the functions, if I translate the functions. This would have compact support, and f would have compact support, and that thing would have compact support, because it just multiplies by something.
And the other thing is that the Fourier transform of a constant times x, I don't know what it is. Is it 1 over c times the Fourier transform of s over c or something like that? Anybody know if that's right? Every time I need it, I rederive it. Something like that. What it means is that I can do those tricks and move my support and shove it around wherever I want. Nobody actually said those facts to say why it was relevant to shove it around and stick it in the interval from 0 to 1 half. So we may translate and scale. To assume f is supported in the interval from 0 to 1 half.
Can you scroll back up to the definition of closure? The compact support.
The support of f,
support of f
is the closure of the set. So the set where f is not equal to 0 is open if f is continuous. And the closure just means this would be a closed and bounded set, which means it's stuck inside some interval.
Okay, so if it's supported on 0, 1 half, it's not automatically supported on 0, 1.
Its support would be, 0, 1 half is inside 0, 1, so it would be...
Right.
Yeah, but the support's in there, so it might...
It would definitely be 0 at 0 and 1 half. So the function might look like this. So we have a 0... and a half. One is going to be an interesting point. But my function is dead zero out here, and then it bumps up and does who knows what, and then it's dead zero afterwards. And instead of my usual notation, or our standard notation, for this problem, I'm going to write, so that, and let's suppose f hat is 0 for absolute s bigger than n,
where n is an integer, a big, maybe big. So it has compact support, so there at least is one big, an n like that, so that f is 0 out there. F hat is 0. And now, to avoid confusion with Fourier series and a Fourier transform, I'm going to be careful. So we're going to, so the clever idea, let's consider the Fourier series for f on the interval 0 from 1, 0 to 1. Okay, instead of writing, I'm going to write a sub n instead of my usual notation of this, because that this is a Fourier series notation, but it's also my Fourier transform notation. So I got to make sure I don't get those two things mixed up. I'm going to call it am today instead of the usual.
And of course, that's the integral from 0 to 1 of f of x e to the minus I n x dx. Is there a 2 pi in there?
Yeah. Oh, no.
No? That's why I always say let 2 pi be 1, because I always forget where to stick the 2 pi.
It should be in the exponential, I think.
It is?
Okay, you're right.
Pretty sure.
Because usually I take pi to pi, and this is 0 to 1. So this would be a 2 pi... x dx.
Yeah.
2 pi nx dx.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And when you stare at that, you realize, aha, that's going to be, because I have this zeroness for the, that's the This is the same
as the Fourier transform. So the aha moment is that this is the same as the, remember, f is zero outside that interval. So this is the same as this integral. And that is the Fourier transform at n.
Or this is the real Fourier transform,
not the Fourier series.
And that's going to be equal to zero when n is bigger than n.
So if absolute n is bigger than capital N.
That's cool. That means, well, so that some people mistakenly, that means that my f is a trig polynomial. But
it's only a trig polynomial. So we can, the ha-ha here is that we conclude that f of x is the summation an e to the I 2 pi n x as n goes from minus n to capital N is a trig polynomial. But what some people didn't realize is that that's only valid on the interval from 0 to 1. Because outside the interval from 0 to 1, it's 0.
So here's a freaky thing. We have this f. It's a trig polynomial of 0, 1, and it's 0 outside. And if you think about that for a minute, you realize trig polynomials can't add up to be 0. But it's 0 outside, and this is only valid on the interval from 0 to 1. And then you realize, oh, Stein gave me what I needed, because my function was going to be supported on 0, 1 half. So I've got the other half there is going to be where it's identically 0.
So the big but here is, but f vanishes on the interval from 1 half to 1. That's an open set. And trig polynomials can't vanish on an open set. And various people did various things to show that. So here's a fact. A trig poly that vanishes on an open set must be the zero trig poly. Vanishes on an open set has to be identically zero.
The nicest, cleanest proof of that is when you think about it, e to the I something nx, that can be expressed in terms of sines and cosines. And sines and cosines are given by convergent power series.
So here's y. E to the I 2 pi nx, that would be cosine 2 pi nx plus I sine 2 pi nx. And these things are given by convergent power series with infinite radius of convergence. So these are equal convergent power series with radius of convergence infinite.
And so Taylor's theorem is going to be what tells you that if this thing is identically zero, write out the power series, add them all up, combine all the coefficients, and you see that the coefficients have to be zero.
So it's going to be a fact, Taylor's formula. namely that the when you collect the coefficients, now I call them A, I'll call these capital A n's, would be the nth derivative at, pick a point, it could be the point in 1/2, how about 3/4? Taylor's formula at the center, x naught equals 3/4, would be zero.
And so the Taylor's power series is the zero power series.
And it converges for all x, so that means the function is identically zero. We get the zero power series when you collect all the terms in real and imaginary parts.
So f is identically zero, and that's the contradiction. So that's it. Yeah. Funny, so I got this proof from reading somebody's paper. My proof that I did when I was thinking about this problem beforehand was, okay, I know that f is equal to a trig polynomial on that interval. So here's an alternative way of doing it. So I calculated the Fourier transform. That would be the integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x dx, e to the minus I 2 pi n, not n, sx dx. And this thing is a trig polynomial, summation a n e to the I 2 pi n x. From minus n to plus n. And then I calculated those things. And it's easy. Then let's see, this would be, f is only supported. Oops, I wrote something wrong here.
Before I do this, f is only supported from 0 to 1. And so this is on that interval, that's where it's the trig polynomial. And you can actually compute this, and you get a sum from minus n to n of, what do you get? When I do the integration, I get 1 over 2 pi s minus n, or n minus s, something like that, a n.
Like that. And look at those. These Fourier things are blowing up when s approaches n. So then you look at the first big one, it can't do that. And so you figure out that each of the ans has to be zero. That is my kind of... I don't like my way as well as the way some of you did it. Yeah, you can calculate those integrals. And so you see that those ans have to be zero.
So boom, at n equals s. So an has to be equal to zero. And you get all the ans have to be zero that way.
Can you explain the connection to the Heisenberg equation?
Well, so in quantum mechanics, you don't know, apparently you have a probability distribution for where the particle is. You're never really sure where it is, but the more concentrated that peak is, the more sure you are that the particle is in that box. So the more sure you are, that means sort of
your probability distribution is getting really concentrated and compactly supported on a small thing, then the less sure you are about what its momentum is, and the momentum is its Fourier transform. So that probability distribution of the momentum is the Fourier transform of that thing. And so when that gets concentrated, the transform gets spread out, and you lose certainty of what the momentum is. But that's a very quantum mechanics way of looking at things, and you have to study some pretty advanced physics to have seen those equations. Well, I thought I'd give you a list of topics that would be relevant for the exam on Friday, and talk about going to grad school in math and physics and wherever you're going to end up, and answer any questions. And if you have any questions about anything, I'll answer them there too. Okay. By the way, if you're not coming ever back ever again, I really enjoyed this class and it's been fun. This is fantastic material and I get a bang out of it. I hope you did too.
Are there any other classes like on Fourier analysis or something?
Well, you're starting to get into a graduate level. That's the next obvious step. So taking a course on partial differential equations like 523, taking a course on distributions like 542, that's what comes next after this. And functional analysis. A lot of math called functional analysis was invented because of this. Hilbert space, stuff like that. But that's, you're approaching the graduate level. You're on the cusp, I would say.
I know you sound bad, but I think my homework 7th grade is not up. I was just wondering.
Is where?
My homework 7th grade is
not there.
Blackboard now.
Oh.
I don't know if you...
Do you have your paper?
I do have it, but I don't have it right now.
If you just email me the score, I'll input it. Maybe...
okay.
Maybe
I don't know if that changes.
Would change something in the positive direction, probably.
Yeah,
I'll look at that. Yeah, so if you email me your score, I'll input it and redo the calculation.
Okay, thank you so much.
Hey, Professor, I'm sorry for running in a little late. I had a presentation. But what you said something in the beginning of the class about the grading and the findings.
Yeah. What was it? So if you did you get your score and everything off the blackboard?
Yes.
So your total score is a number. And I decided if you score between 286 and 300, you get an A plus and you don't need to take the final.
Okay. Thank you.
And for the other people who might have cared, if they do take the final, it can only affect their total score in a positive way.
Okay.
I'll post this on the usual spot. So
okay.
You,
thanks.
So thank you. There will be proof out there.
So now I passed the required score,
yeah.
A minus.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if I get into the exam,
if you come to the exam and do better, then you can improve that.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I don't like writing exam. I feel
nobody likes it.
And
you're almost done. When you're done taking classes and writing a thesis, you won't have to do it anymore.
Yeah.
I know how you feel, because when I finished my classes at MIT, I took a class in pottery, and they said, okay, the final exam is going to be make a pot. I said, can't do it. I'm done with final exams.
Okay, so now I get to 206, so I'm in B minus range. So if I enter the exam, it will be more...
You can improve, yeah. So, I mean, if you do B or better on the final, then on that final, then
it's better than B minus.
It could bump it up to a B or higher. Who knows if you do really well on it.
Okay.
And then the final will, in fact, I'm taking problems from old 527 exams.
Yeah.
And not making them multiple choice. So, I'll tell you the material that you need to know. And you're allowed one crib sheet. So it'll be more like an engineering exam at 527.
Yeah, it was a problem for me in the midterm. I thought that you will give us a sheet for the equation.
You thought I was going to do that?
Yeah, so I didn't solve one of the problems.
Okay, well this time you're allowed a crib sheet.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
I have a 5:30 question.